I created Death Race 6 years ago. I now have as many viewers as the Super Bowl. The drivers are convicts, and the rules are simple. There are no rules.
This is Junk Food Cinema.
Hi, this is Dick Miller. You're listening to Junk Food Cinema on Film School Rejects. Who are these guys?
Welcome back to Junk Food Cinema. This is the weekly cult and exploitation film cast here on FilmSchoolRejects.com that is so good, it just has to be fattening. I am your host, Brian Salisbury, and joining me, as always, he is my friend, my co-pilot, my navigator, you might say, for this particular episode. You know him as a former film critic. He is an author. He is a screenwriter, currently co-writing Marvel's Doctor Strange, Mr. C. Robert Cargill.
Hi.
How's it going, Cargill?
Yeah, you know, it was going really well, and then you like went for the navigator joke.
No, it's not a joke. You are my navigator.
Well, yeah. So I'm the hot chick bust in from the women's prison.
Yes.
Great.
I don't understand what your problem is. I'm breaking down gender mores every day of the week on this show. That is what we do. And if you would like to hear more of what we do on this show, you can visit us on iTunes as well as on Stitcher. All of our cataloged episodes are there. You can also follow us on Twitter at Junk Food Cinema and like the podcast on Facebook, facebook.com/junkfoodcinema. Cargill, I am especially excited about today's episode because this is a theme that we have been talking about pretty much since the podcast started, a show that we've been wanting to do since day one.
Yeah, it's kind of odd that it took us this long to get here. This was, I believe this may have been the very first movie night I hosted over at my house.
Yeah.
That you came to back when, got a decade ago.
Yeah, it seems like it. Shit.
When you had just moved to town and a bunch of us from Fantastic Fest started hanging out and watching movies together. And I wanted to have everybody over to show Death Race 2000, which, you know, very few people at the in our group had seen. And then to back it up with Death Race, which everyone had kind of skipped because it was
it's a remake.
Well, not only it's a remake, but it was a Paul W.S. Anderson movie.
Yes.
So people were like, you know, fuck that movie. Fuck that guy. And so nobody saw it. And I realized that I knew all these people that had seen neither of these movies. So I'm like, fuck it. I'm throwing this. I'm going to watch both of these movies tonight because I, of course, had seen them and loved them. And I'm showing both of these. And everybody showed up and they're like, all right, whatever. And then everybody had a blast because both movies are highly entertaining for very different reasons.
Yes.
And make a wonderful double feature. And that night in particular, I chased it down with a midnight movie.
Oh, yes, I remember.
Which melted your brain and changed the course of history forever.
That's right. In the future, kings will be born, asteroids will collide, all because of the events set in motion from watching these two films back-to-back. There's, of course, Death Race 2000 from 1975 and Death Race from 2008. Okay, so a little backstory. Let's go back even further than that 2008 movie night that we're talking about. Let's go back to when I was a kid and my brother and I would spend our summers with my grandmother, and she was a VHS fiend. Like, she would go to garage sales every week and she would just buy every tape she could get her hands on. And she was something of a cult movie buff herself, and she started telling me about this movie called Death Race 2000.
The year 2000. America is a vast speedway. People line the streets to witness the greatest drivers on Earth in a race from sea to shining sea.
This is a death race.
You finish first, or not at all. Death Race 2000.
And the entire premise of it, to hear it from her, was these cars drive around and they hit people and they get points for it. And at the time, as a kid, I was like, that sounds awesome. So I sat down and watched it, and sure enough, I thought it was awesome. I thought it was, as a kid, I was like, well, this is a really old movie, but it's really great.
Oddly enough, I'm 40 years old, and that sounds awesome.
Yeah, It has never stopped being awesome. I mean, this is a film directed by Paul Bartel, who is not only one of Corman's go-to directors, but one of Corman's go-to actors as well.
Oh,
and you see him appear in a number of films, Rock and Roll High School, and in this movie in particular, he has a small part at the beginning. But Death Race 2000 was one of those films that just was like wildly just unhinged. And as a kid, I loved that it was like violent, but it was funny and it was weird. And it just kind of pushed all my buttons. And it was one of those like weird little discoveries that I didn't know at the time, but would kind of define me as a film fan for the rest of my life. It's just finding these little movies that are just so off the beaten track that they can kind of make their own rules. And that epitomizes Roger Corman, if you ask me. And then Death Race, the 2008 remake, is, I will admit, a film that I avoided because by and large, remakes kind of, you know, they can be pretty damn disappointing. I mean, I have since kind of come around on them, and there are a lot of remakes that I swear by now, but, you know, even at the time, you know, just 8 years ago, I was like, I don't know, remakes, I'm just not sure. And sure enough, Paul W.S. Anderson does something so incredibly interesting with the framework that was laid down by Corman's original film. But let's start at the beginning, at the starting line, if you will. Death Race 2000 supposes a future where, in the year 2000, the number one sport in the country is the transcontinental race. And in the transcontinental race, the drivers score points for running down and murdering various groups of people. You get a certain number of points for teenagers, you get more points for the elderly, you get more points for women, and you get like the most points if you kill infants. Which, I mean, just as I'm explaining that, and Kergel, maybe you agree with this, as I'm just explaining the concept of it, it sounds like a really dark film, right? Like, it sounds like something that would be like a twisted horror film. But it's a comedy.
It's a very bizarre, tongue-in-cheek satire. Capitalizing on, you know, human bloodlust. Mm-hmm. And taking it to truly absurd levels.
Yeah.
Like, I mean, it is a really, really absurd film, which is what's so amazing about it. It really is crazy, stupid, over the top, surreal, odd, campy, and funny.
Yeah.
It's a perfect 70s drive-in movie. Like, it is
absolutely.
It is just truly unbelievably absurd. And, and tonally speaking, it's, yeah, you'd think this is stuff of, you know, horror or something really grisly. And instead, it's really kind of funny.
Instead, it's a live-action version of Wacky Racers.
Yeah.
Like, it is, like, all of the characters in this film are so broadly drawn that they really do, like, I mean, this is something you hear a lot. It's kind of an old chestnut now when people say that a movie feels like a cartoon. This movie feels entirely like a 1970s Hanna-Barbera Saturday morning cartoon, specifically Wacky Racers, where you have a character played by David Carradine called Frankenstein, who is all in leather from head to toe, even though it's not real leather. It's supposed to be leather. And he's this, he's got a cape, and he drives a car that looks like a dragon. And he's one of these, he's a racer who has been in, you know, the film tells us that he's been in all of these heinous accidents and he's basically been reconstructed. At the beginning of the film, they say he's had a limb transplant, multiple limb transplants. And then you have a character called Machine Gun Joe, who dresses like a swing dancer, has a Tommy gun, and is played by an insanely young Sylvester Stallone, who even at the time was apparently writing his own lines on set, because there is never a point in the continuum of Sylvester Stallone where he isn't trying to take control of the movie he's in, regardless of who's actually in charge.
Oh, yeah.
And then you have a character named Calamity Jane, who is a female cowboy. You have a character named Matilda the Hun, who is a female Nazi. And then you have a character named Nero who, I mean, again, so broadly drawn and so ridiculous as to resemble Wacky Racers. And that's entirely how this film starts out. They're going from one side of the country to the other. And it takes place in this dystopian future where they keep making reference to the president of the United States sort of having now this this global reach, this global power, where he has like a summer home in Peking, and you know we are apparently at war with the French, which I thought was a really interesting choice for a movie made in the 70s to suppose this global conflict, and the country we're at war with is not Russia, but France. But I mean, that's kind of how the race is presented. Is, you know, we live in this kind of now totalitarian society where the president of the United States is president of the whole world, very much like the way Futurama kind of diagrams political power in the future. And so the race becomes a way to kind of keep the masses in line, much like the gladiatorial sports of ancient Rome. And yet, working against them now is this small faction of rabble-rousers led by Thomasina Paine, in one of the most ham-fisted references to the American Revolution I think I've ever experienced, Thomasina Paine. And so they are plotting to kind of derail the race, kidnap Frankenstein, and hold him for ransom so that they can kind of subvert and bring down this totalitarian system. I mean, I think that's pretty much the long and the short of it. And that sounds like a pretty interesting, pretty well-thought-out framework, but in the midst of that is just a lot of campy violence, a lot of tits and ass for absolutely no reason other than it is a Corman film, and just these really bizarre characters. But it's so much fun!
Oh, yeah. No, it's so goofy and such a good time. And everybody's chewing up the scenery in this.
Like it is covered in peanut butter.
It is. Sylvester Stallone's Machine Gun Joe is just so delightfully over the top and in your face and just all around funny.
Yeah.
I mean, that's the big takeaway with this thing is it is just, it's a movie you can't take seriously, but that you can't write off either. Like it is such, I mean, and that's really, it's really a credit to Paul Bartel, who, you know, most people, if you saw Paul Bartel, you'd recognize him. He was really good at playing snooty, uptight characters, in films, was in over 90 films and television shows. But had this very crazy cult sense of humor and made such weird little movies like Eating Raoul,
yeah,
and Cannonball, not Cannonball Run, Cannonball,
also starring
David Carradine, yeah, and Lust in the Dust, which is a movie that almost nobody's seen. Like he made just these very weird, particular films, and they all share this kind of zany, culty sense of humor. And this is what I think, you know, really comes to bear and is ultimately his best film, because it really does hit all the right satirical points, and it really is. It falls in this weird place in history, oddly enough, in that it's, this movie comes after A Boy and His Dog, but before the Mad Max movies.
Mm-hmm.
So this is in the very early proto stages of post-apocalyptic dystopian cinema. Like, we don't have a visual language for dystopian cinema yet. This is the era that shortly after this is where we're going to get all of our dystopian masterpieces, where we're going to get our Blade Runner and our Escape from New York and Mad Max and Mad Max 2, a.k.a. The Road Warrior, that ultimately would then inform what the post-apocalyptic or dystopian future should look like in a film. This comes right before that. But after we've gotten, you know, the first real post-apocalyptic movies, which, you know, the visually post-apocalyptic with A Boy and His Dog, and previously, just shortly before that,
The Day After.
I was going to say I'm trying to remember the name of the version of I Am Legend.
Oh, Last Man on Earth. Yeah, with Vincent Price.
Vincent Price's version. So, and then of course, you know, Omega Man. Mm-hmm. So, this is in that era where we're not really sure what this is supposed to look like yet. And so they create such a really unique, strange vision of the future. You know, it's a matte painted apocalypse of sorts.
Yeah.
Which is kind of fucking cool.
Yeah, I mean, this is, I think what's interesting about the era that you're talking about that came before this versus this era of post-apocalyptic films is that post-apocalyptic cinema at this point stops being cautionary tales, stops being like the filmic equivalent of, you know, all the PSAs, all the duck and cover, and we start to embrace apocalypse. And none of those films you mentioned maybe more so than Death Race 2000, which embraces the post-apocalypse so much that it dives through the Warner logo and starts running around like it's Bugs Bunny in the apocalypse. Like, it is having so much fun with the world that it's created. But what's crazy about it to me, what I think is really the brilliance of Paul Bartel and you know, to a certain extent, Roger Corman, is that they take something that is this crazy and this cartoonish, and yet there is still a modicum of political satire to this. Like, they are still poking fun, not even so much at political systems, but at the masses themselves. And, you know, at the time, I you know, you talk about football being a major sport. You have, you know, Monday Night Football starting to become a big thing, which is why there's a character in this movie who looks and sounds exactly like Howard Cosell. That's not an accident. That's because this is around the same time that Monday Night Football started to become a mainstay. And so what this film is kind of poking more fun at and really subverting is the idea that...
Is Howard Cosell.
And how, you know, audiences in America then, and I think it's funny how much this translates even now, were just delighting and watching people brutalize each other for sport. So this feels like an extrapolation of how much people liked watching football or boxing and just taking it the extra step. But the genius of Bartel and Corman is that they knew exactly where to stop short of this being heavy-handed, of this being a political movie. This is still full-on entertaining drive-in fare, but it has those little moments that feel very pointedly directed, you know, shining that mirror on all of us and poking fun at ourselves as opposed to having sort of a tone of reproach. And I think that's why the movie, even in its moments of most critical of society, still feels really fun, because, I mean, it's still Roger Corman trying to make a movie to make a buck. And talk about cutting corners, which is a staple of every Corman film, coming in on a budget. Most of the scenes where there's racing or there are dangerous stunts, Roger Corman and his crew are driving these cars because the stunt drivers refused to do certain shots, not because they were dangerous, but because Corman didn't have permits. So Corman is driving around the freeways of LA in modified Volkswagens, which sometimes couldn't even start, so they had to be pushed down hills to make it look like they were going fast. And he's in the driver's seat himself, driving around without permits to get these shots. And I think that's one of the really great things about this movie is, as clunky as these cars are, there's a lot of great fun to be had with the cinematography in all of the driving sequences. Like, it's a lot of fun to watch. And it should be, like, when you know that they've just bought Volkswagens and stripped down the chassis and stuck these ridiculous bodies on top of them, this should look like a Pinewood Derby, is what it should look like, just from all the modifications and how fast they can actually go to get these shots. And yet, it's actually shot pretty damn well.
Yeah.
And it makes for a really good time.
And it has an interesting place in Corman history, in that this is one of his big successes.
Yes.
This did very well, and he tried several times to duplicate that success, because that's what he did. As Corman talks about, is, you know, he hails from an era before the sequel, where mm-hmm. before adding a number to a thing was a thing you could just get away with doing. So whenever you'd have something, as he famously talked about, you know, you'd make a movie about sexy nighttime nurses and that would do really well. So then you'd tweak it and next year you'd release sexy candy stripers and,
yes.
You know, and you would ride that until the wheels fell off, until people didn't want to see sexy nurses anymore. And this was one of those movies that worked for him that he just started experimenting. That's why just a year later, all of a sudden we see Cannonball, which let's bring David Carradine back and put him in a real cross country race. And that didn't do so well. So they're like, well, it's, and then, you know, 2 years after that, we get Death Sport, which was, oh, hey, that's what really worked. Let's go from Death Race 2000 to Death Sport.
Yeah.
And they kept playing around with that until, again, the wheels fell off.
Yeah.
Of course, that rode us right up into that era that I was just talking about, where, you know, we have some of the great dystopian masterpieces of the early 80s, which kind of changed everything and also changed everything for you, because that era was where we saw the Italian knockoffs explode. And that's what we, that night that we showed Death Race v. Death Race, we also showed you After the Fall of New York,
yeah,
for the first time, which was a knockoff of all of those films. So it's a really interesting, wonderful film that really did kind of hit the right spot at the right time.
And there are so many scenes in this movie that I just feel like no other producer, no other filmmaker would have been able to get away with, just because it's so fucking weird. Like the scene, there's a scene in this movie where Frankenstein, who every one of these drivers has a, again, it's very much like Wacky Racers. They have like their little sidekick in the car with them, right?
Stop that pigeon, stop that pigeon, stop that pigeon.
Yeah, exactly.
See, you're going to have that. You've been trying Wacky Racers tonight, and it's just in the back of my head, it's all Muttley right now.
If Frankenstein is Dick Dastardly, then, you know, this beautiful blonde woman is Muttley. If Sylvester Stallone is Machine Gun Joe, then his buxom companion is the other Hillbilly Bears. I don't know. But, yeah, I love Wacky Racers. I will watch
really
it any day of the week. Yeah, so they have, you know, they have these partners in the car with them, and suddenly what starts happening is instead of getting the kills that they want on the road, somebody keeps knocking all of them off, and it's causing them a lot of stress. But there's a moment where it's a pause in the action because the race takes place over 3 days. There's three legs to the race. And on one of the breaks, Frankenstein and his blonde navigator lady, just they're having this discussion, and it's, I mean, everyone else is just boning their co-pilot like crazy, but he, in his underwear, asks her to dance, and it's this, like, really bizarre, like, not, it's like a waltz, but they're mostly nude, but it's not played sexy, it's played, like, for almost old romance, and it's just, it's a bizarre, it grinds the movie to a halt, I will admit that, but it's just, like, you can't not look at it, because it is so bonkers. And I love that about this movie, that it has the, it understands that it has enough. It has met the quota of the things that are going to get people to buy those tickets to the drive-in, that it starts doing all of these bizarre things on top of it that are at moments really great, at moments really odd, and at moments just so bizarre that you can't take your eyes off of it. So it's, there is nothing ordinary about this movie, even as basic as its aims are, as to, you know, to have some violence, have some laughs. You know, these really cartoonish characters and get people in. There is nothing, the approach to it is not ordinary in the least. And actually, Kergo, I thought it would blow your mind a little bit. Do you remember the scene where Calamity Jane's car looks like a bull, by the way? And there's a scene where there is,
because this movie is anything but subtle.
Oh, it is not subtle at all. This is a movie that was sold, and this is a true story. This is a movie that was sold to foreign distributors with concept art. Corman had someone draw what he wanted the cars to look like, and that's how they got the movie financed. So again, subtlety was not in the blueprint of this movie, literally. But there's a scene where a matador is basically taunting Calamity Jane's bull car and like throwing the cape around it. And of course, he eventually meets a grisly end. But do you know who plays that matador?
I don't.
Louis Teague, director of Alligator.
Oh, that makes sense.
Yes, another graduate of the School of Corman, but Alligator is another film that we both love. And
yes.
I only just learned this today that Matador is played by Louis Teague.
I did not realize that.
And that cracks me up.
And that makes so much sense in terms of what was happening in the Corman camp in the 70s. The 70s is when Corman brought on all those guys who would then, many of whom would turn out to be, you know, they were just these young geeks who loved working with Corman because they grew up on Corman movies and they worked, they idolized Corman actors and they were all geeking out on sets. Like, oh my God, I can't believe we're making movies and we're making movies with these people. And they would just show up and be in each other's movies. Like they would just, somebody would be shooting a movie and everybody would show up, whether to work on it or just to show up and hang around because they just wanted to be nerds together. And so, of course, that makes sense that this is exactly what happened here.
Well, and that continues on. I mean, even after, you know, these filmmakers stop working with Corman, you still see a lot of crossover. I mean, Joe Dante, who was a member
one of those guys.
I mean, later on when you watch Gremlins, you might recognize the voice of Don Steele as Rockin' Ricky Rialto, kind of the DJ slash kind of just the voice in the background throughout the whole movie. He's also in this movie playing almost the exact same character.
And who shows up in Gremlins as well? Another Corman, you know, staple.
Dick Miller, of course. I was surprised.
The patron saint of our tiny little show.
That's true. He absolutely is the patron saint of our show. And I was surprised not to see him in this. There was one moment I rewatched this where I swore I was like, I think one of the engineers working with Thomasina Payne, there's just one shot. I was like, I think that's Dick Miller. And I rewound it several times and kept up. I was like, that's not Dick Miller. But I really want Dick Miller to be in this because for me, it's not a Corman film. It's not a complete Corman film until I see Dick Miller.
That, you know what? That's what this film needed. This film needed more Dick Miller. More racer played by Dick Miller.
Absolutely. I agree with that 100%. And I think there's some credit that is due to the editor to this as well, because the way that it approaches violence is that it is really gory, but it's so quick. It gives you just a taste of it to where the violence doesn't feel overbearing to the point that you feel like you're watching a horror movie. The amount of blood and the specificity of the way people die is very horrific, but it'll do this thing where like it'll show Calamity Jane's car, the horn of the car plowing through someone's chest and blood going everywhere, and then immediately cut to like Calamity Jane putting on her makeup. Like there's just, it's so irreverent, and even in the editing, that you can't for a second take the violence too seriously, which again lends itself to the cartoon nature. To the point, by the way, that there is literally a scene where someone pulls the fake tunnel gag a la the Roadrunner and the Coyote on one of the racers. I mean, you want to talk about a movie that feels like a cartoon? They literally pull the fake tunnel entrance one of the racers.
I wouldn't be surprised if that was part of Bartel's inspiration in this, was to, like, he's like, look, this is a cartoon. Let's make it a cartoon.
Yeah.
And it is cartoonish. I mean, throughout, through and through.
Very much so. And it's interesting, too, that this was David Carradine's first movie after walking off of Kung Fu. This is the first movie he signed on to. And when he was asked about it later, he said that his agent told him, look, if you don't take a movie right away, you may never get to do a movie because you're a TV guy. So he wanted to do something. He was told specifically that he needed to get rid of the image of playing, quote, that little Chinese guy from Kung Fu by playing a monster. So he literally steps into a movie where his character's name is Frankenstein to...
And he's wearing a leather mask.
Yes.
And...
To effectively shake that off and you know, kind of reestablish himself. But, I mean, this movie is just so funny and so bonkers and so crazy violent at the same time. I mean, it is just a hodgepodge. It's a casserole of cult film... Things we appreciate about cult films. So we jump ahead to 2008...
I want you to drive for me.
What do you think? I'm gonna risk my life doing this for you.
I'm offering you your freedom. All you have to do is walk off that track alive and win, of course.
This is not your typical, it's not the typical flow, I think, for a remake to follow its predecessor. I mean, this is, what, 33 years later? No, 33 years later. Paul W.S. Anderson, who I think kind of deserves, if junk food cinema had a walk of fame, and that walk would be spelled W-O-K, because we are all about the junk food on this show, Paul W.S. Anderson has his own place there. Because Paul W.S. Anderson is a guy that makes movies that are very, very bad, but in some cases, so much fun to behold. Like, Mortal Kombat, for example, is a fucking awful... I disagree that it's good, but it's a lot of fun to watch.
Oh, man, is that movie entertaining.
Oh, it's very entertaining. It is absolutely...
No. If you want to talk about, like, terrible and yet entertaining Paul W.S. Anderson movies, you're talking about, like, Three Musketeers. Like, that movie's god-awful. Like, it's god-awful, but man, is it fun. Like, they take a Three Musketeers movie and rip off The Matrix beat for beat in a scene. They're like, how could we want to make this like The Matrix? Well, The Matrix is a science fiction movie. Yeah, no, just the scene where they rescue Morpheus. How do we duplicate the part where they come in with the helicopter? Well, we could do it with airships, and they fucking recreate beat for beat the escape from The Matrix. And he does stuff like that, but he occasionally makes wonderful, wonderful films, like one we talked about last year.
Event Horizon. Yeah, absolutely.
And this.
Yeah.
Which is a legitimately good movie.
I think if we're ranking his films in terms of legitimate quality, not entertainment value, but legitimate quality, this is just below Event Horizon. Like, this film...
I like this better than Event Horizon.
Wow! Yeah. Strong words. So this film takes place in, actually, I think it's 2012. And what's really funny about that is that we have the previous film, made in 1975, predicting a dystopian future by the year 2000 that we have not yet seen, although Ted Cruz is still in the running for president, so could happen. But what
Let's get political.
I'm putting my headband on. I'm going to sweat it out like Olivia Newton-John. But this movie
I'm going to sweat it out in Olivia Newton's John.
Oh, yeah. This movie supposes too optimistically a dystopia, because the opening scroll of the film is like, in the year 2012, the economy of the United States collapses. And I remember watching this at your house and going, we didn't make it that far, because the economy collapsed in 2008 when this film was released. So in other words, this is supposing that we have more time before our collapse than we actually had. So well done for being prescient, Paul W.S. Anderson. But in this film, Death Race is not a cross-country race. It is a prison blood sport that is available on pay-per-view to the masses.
Okay, this is where I have to... I'm going to just pull this out right now.
Don't do that. This is a family show. Put that away.
No, it's not. This has never been a family show.
What the fuck are you talking about?
In true Corman fashion...
Who is a producer on this, by the way?
Corman is a producer on this. In true Corman fashion, this movie is not just a remake of Death Race 2000. This movie also rips off another famous science fiction dystopian film, because they didn't remake Death Race 2000. That's why these movies make such a great double feature, because it is not a true remake. It is borrowing elements from Death Race 2000 to fucking rip off The Running Man.
Yes.
This movie is the Running Man. Beat the fucking Running Man. An innocent man is set up to,
to be a criminal
and to be a contestant in a televised event, which is all about bloodthirst and which makes almost no sense in terms of how is this game even really a game. It's really just watching people murder each other with kind of a hint of a game, and it's run by some evil person that our hero vows he will get, and then the movie goes on beat for beat being fucking Running Man.
Yeah.
And it is kind of fucking awesome that way.
Yes. And here's what you do. Take the Running Man, replace Richard Dawson with cinema's most deceptively sexy blonde, Joan Allen,
yeah.
And she becomes she's the warden of the prison where all of the worst criminals are sent, including, unfortunately, our hero, played by Jason Statham, who has got his 5 o'clock shadow just rocking, and he's ready to go. He's a former NASCAR driver who is working in a factory. It gets shut down. He's down on his luck. His wife is murdered, and he's framed for the murder and sent to this prison.
To replace.
See, this is what's really interesting, because this movie revolves, like, one of the biggest plot points of this film is an element from the original that is thrown away,
yeah.
That is introduced in one scene and completely thrown away and never has any relevance again. And that moment in the original is you find out that David Carradine's character, who they keep talking about the whole movie, was put back together after all these, he's all sewn together and he's barely stitched up because of all these accidents. Turns out, he says, he was raised in a government facility, and when they use up one Frankenstein, they just get another. But that line literally is thrown away before he fucks his navigator, and it never comes up again. In this film, it's basically the central premise of the movie is that we don't, like, Frankenstein is a racer who wears a mask. At the beginning of this movie, he's killed, and they need a new Frankenstein. Because the deal with...
Who's the Frankenstein at the beginning of this movie?
It is, I believe,
David Carradine.
Although, yeah. Funny enough, when you watch it, the first four times I watched this movie, I swore that was Ian McShane's voice. If you listen, it sounds like fucking Ian McShane, who plays a character in the film, which for a while you're like, wait, are they trying to say that Ian McShane was... But apparently that's David Carradine. It just happens to sound, in the way it's mixed, Ian McShane. Never,
you know, he doesn't swear, so
that's
how you know it's Carradine.
He doesn't call his co-pilot a cocksucker, so I guess, yep. You know it's not Ian McShane.
Why is Lovejoy in this movie?
There's not enough swear engine. So the beginning of the movie, that Frankenstein dies. Jason Statham is given an opportunity. The whole thing about Death Race is that if a certain racer wins three times, or I think it's five times, they win five times, they're given their freedom. And Frankenstein has won four times. So basically, Jason Statham is given this deal that if he, if he inhabits Frankenstein and wins that last race, he will earn his freedom. And if not, they're basically going to ship his daughter off to some foster family he'll never see. So he's blackmailed into it.
Gee, this sounds an awful lot like The Running Man.
It does, doesn't it? It sounds like maybe there's something underhanded going on. Maybe they just wanted him to keep the ratings up. Who knows? But here's the difference between the two films. Apart from revolving, like this one revolving around such a throwaway conceit from the first one, is that this movie may have moments where in its execution it feels a little silly, but there's really nothing that silly about it. In fact, how seriously it takes itself and the action is what makes it so entertaining to watch. This is a straight-up action movie that is impressive in the way that it constructs and executes its action sequences. Like, the majority of the things you see going on in this film, by the way, are practical effects.
Oh, and that's one of the things that I would argue. There are three movies that Paul W.S. Anderson has made that are all, I feel, are legitimately good. We clearly disagree on one of those, which is Mortal Kombat. But Mortal Kombat, Event Horizon, and this are three of his only films that are almost entirely practical effects, that he is immersed in these worlds, that he, all of his visual creativity is put into physical sets as opposed to playing around with green screens in his digital wonderland, which is where I think he really goes off the reservation. I think anytime he's playing around digitally, he doesn't have the restrictions that challenges him to make his best films. And this film, he did all of this practically. They would take an hour to reload 6,000 rounds into machine guns that, you know, that are firing 6,000 blanks.
Which, by the way, these cars look amazing.
Fucking awesome.
Oh my God. If the cars in the original film look like wacky racers, the cars in the remake look like George Miller's wet dream.
Yes.
They are beautiful.
I'm glad you mentioned, because that's really the thing, is George Miller is kind of known as the king of post-apocalyptic car movies, mm-hmm. and these cars are all so much cooler than anything in any fucking Miller movie. And I know there's people out there going, sacrilege! But it's fucking true.
Yeah.
These fucking cars fucking rock.
If you thought Humongous's oil tanker was impressive, wait till you see the goddamn dreadnought.
The dreadnought is fucking awesome.
Release the dreadnought. It's said by Joan Allen, but I feel like you could hear Liam Neeson's voice coming out of her a la Clash of the Titans. Like, release the dreadnought. And by the way, Joan Allen in this movie is having so much fun playing this bitch.
I'll show you who shits on the sidewalk.
She spends the whole movie like the more badass version of Hadley, Warden Hadley from Shawshank Redemption. Yeah. And she has this whole thing about swearing. She doesn't let anybody swear. And then at the end of the movie, like, people are getting so under her skin that she starts swearing to a degree that it is just absurd. But she delivers it with so much conviction that you can't help but be like, fuck yeah, we will see who shits on the sidewalk. What does that mean? Who says that ever? What? Like, I don't understand. But you believe it because Joan Allen says it. And she is so cold. She is so, like, lizard-like in her iciness in this film. And it's so perfect. So perfect.
Yeah. Yeah. This movie, the characters in this movie is what makes this movie. That's the thing, is this movie knows exactly what it is. It is a prison film, and it is a gladiator film. And it is... these characters all are archetypes, and they're all wonderfully executed by a really cool fucking cast.
Yeah.
And oddly enough, Machine Gun Joe. Let's talk about Machine Gun Joe.
Let's jump to this version of Machine Gun Joe.
Okay. Yeah. So we've got Frankenstein, and we get Machine Gun Joe, and these are these are our two major links to the original movie, and of course. Machine Gun Joe is played by
Tyrese Gibson,
who essentially believes he's in another Fast and Furious movie.
But it's funny because he's decided that he's going to play like the Vin Diesel of this Fast and the Furious instead of the Tyrese of this Fast and the Furious, because he's the tough, no nonsense guy, whereas the Tyrese in the Fast and Furious movies is the guy always cracking jokes. This is a more like, this is Tyrese at his most, I am a badass, fucking believe me. And sometimes you will, sometimes you may not, but he is going for it. And I love that about him in this movie.
And you know, what's interesting is that Machine Gun Joe is actually the most interesting character in this fucking movie. Like, you would think Statham's character would have all the interesting angles and character... but no.
Well, they film his jawline from interesting angles a lot.
Yeah, no, he's a very straightforward Frankenstein in this movie is a much more straight, forward, strong jawed character than was ever in the original.
Oh, absolutely.
But Machine Gun Joe may or may not be gay.
Yeah. They introduced that idea almost as an off color insult.
Yeah.
But then, there's never any evidence to the contrary either.
And
it's never denied, nor is there any evidence to the contrary.
But at the same time, he's got this interesting habit of losing his navigators, and his navigators die terribly, and they die in awful ways, sometimes at his hand.
Yeah. All those black guys may as well be wearing red shirts, because as they get in the car with Machine Gun Joe, they're so much so that there's a scene where, like, they're shoving one guy into the car. And he's like, no, I don't want to be the navigator.
And then he's just like, hey. I mean, I just find Machine Gun Joe so much more interesting than anyone else in this movie.
Yeah.
Because he's just, you know, like, Ian McShane is awesome in this movie and is probably at his most charismatic.
I would agree with that.
I mean, I mentioned Lovejoy earlier and, you know, a lot of people in the States don't, I grew up on Lovejoy simply because my dad watched the PBS show Mystery every week. And Mystery was really just a rebranding of, hey, we're going to show you these serialized mystery shows from the BBC. Mm-hmm. And one of them that was Lovejoy that they would show, and which, you know, was Ian McShane when he was young and attractive and was playing the more, the charismatic roles. And then, you know, people just kind of discovered him over here and became the crotchety old man. And, you know, he became known as that character from Deadwood, you know, those cocksuckers were going to get him. And this is the first time in over here in his mainstream success that he's allowed to be like really charming.
Yeah.
And not play the grisly, angry guy. He's actually very kind of mellow and cool. And then you find out his that he's essentially ripped off from Red from the Shawshank Redemption.
Yeah, and
he's actually gotten, he's already served his time. He just doesn't want to leave.
Yeah.
Because he doesn't know what he's going to do on the outside. So instead, he runs the pit crew for Frankenstein. And that's the extent of that character. It's really likable, but that's the extent of it. But Machine Gun Joe just has just mounds and mounds of character to him and is just so interesting to watch. And I think Tyrese Gibson gives one of his better performances.
I would absolutely agree with that. I want to talk for a minute about speaking of the Ian McShane character, about the change, the very fundamental change to the storytelling of this movie that I think is a subtle way to automatically distinguish itself from the original. In the original film, the action is frequently broken by cutting away to the announcers and the TV personalities explaining to you what's going on, which gives the movie that very comedic feel. But in this movie, Frankenstein is an outsider. Jason Statham is coming into a world that already exists, as opposed to David Carradine, who has existed in this world and therefore has no cause to explain to the audience what's going on because he already knows what's going on. Coach, or the Ian McShane character, because Jason Statham, this Frankenstein, was not born into this world, is sort of the avatar for the audience. And as he explains things to Statham, we are more organically being introduced to this Death Race world. And I think that's a really smart move, and I really like the way that they do that. But one of the things that's fascinating about this Death Race is that where the original was sort of playing upon and taking jabs at our society's love of blood sports like football and boxing, there are two things that I think the original couldn't possibly have anticipated in terms of outlets for violent tendencies. One being MMA, which is frequently sold as pay-per-views, which Death Race is a pay-per-view. And the other is video games. And what is Paul Anderson, what has his career been marked by but video game film adaptations? And throughout so much of this movie, and I'm going to say this, I think this is his best video game movie, and it's not even based on a video game. But the structure of the way that we watch Death Race, we watch part of the pay-per-view, is structured exactly like a goddamn racing video game.
Oh, yeah.
To the point that they introduce the drivers, like, in, like, these sweeping shots standing next to their cars with their names floating above their heads.
And Dick Hervasti coming on going, announcing each of them, Pachinko.
Travis Colt.
Grimm.
14K.
Yeah. And it's, and they get you, they, it, like, it's got the chugging guitar, and it's like, on Death Race. You know?
Subscribe now. And they even tell you the prices. I love that. Like,
oh, yeah.
Subscribe to one leg for $99 or subscribe to all three for the low, low price of $249.
Yeah. And the thing is it just, it's so lean and elegant in how it introduces us to our characters, mm-hmm. and how it keeps us abreast of exactly what's going on and what's happening and where we are. And at the same time, making it feel like we're actually watching Death Race.
Yes.
You know, and watching the pay-per-view. And it's so well executed, and it's so fun, and it's just such an entertaining experience that this is the movie. I mean, the reason why I say I think it's better than Event Horizon is this is the Paul W.S. Anderson movie that I've watched the most.
Yeah.
Because you can pop this movie on at any time and just watch it. And it just moves. It just fucking moves. It is on rails. It's a 2-hour movie that just, it feels like it's 25 minutes. It's just, it's in and out. And it is just so much fun.
Yeah.
And that elegance of storytelling and getting you into the event of Death Race. Like when you hear that voice and they show those promos that we were just talking about, you get why people would fucking watch this.
Yeah.
Like all of a sudden it's like, this is kind of fucking cool. Like, yeah. I could understand why people would watch Death Race. I can understand. It's like, why would you pay $250 for an event? Oh, well, there's 99 different cameras that you can choose and watch from the car of your favorite driver. And you can, it's like, oh, well, that's a fucking event. That's interesting.
One of the special features on the Blu-ray for Death Race, by the way, which I highly recommend, is like make your own Death Race where you can actually recut the movie. You can take all of these angles and put them together, and then you hit play, and it plays the version of the movie that you have basically cut from all the angles. So it really does feel like you're watching Death Race.
That's fucking weird.
Yeah, I don't know how they
know that.
I don't know how they pull it off, but they definitely pull it off, where you're actually re-editing the movie from all of the various angles that if you were to have bought Death Race the pay-per-view, you would have had access to. It's crazy. And I think part of it is, I think the reason this sits so highly in the oeuvre of W.S. Anderson is that
there is a phrase that nobody ever thought we would,
the oeuvre of W.S. Anderson.
Yeah, that anyone would ever hear. But that's the kind of wonderful thing you can get every week here on Junk Food Cinema.
That is the kind of patented ridiculousness that can only come from Junk Food Cinema. But it's because he had worked on this movie for 13 years. In fact, if you notice, W.S. Anderson for 13 years was trying to get his adaptation of Death Race 2000 to the big screen. His original idea was to call it Death Race 3000. It was going to be set further in the future where there would be like flying cars, invisible cars, but very much in the Corman style. And I think this is so appropriate because of budgetary constraints. He had to go with this story instead, which in my opinion is such a better story.
Oh yeah.
Such a better way to tell, a bunch of better, a delivery system for this kind of action, so much better. But if you notice, at the beginning of the film, I think it still says this, maybe they dropped off right before, but Tom Cruise and Paula Wagner were originally attached as producers. And if I remember correctly, at least one of them still shows up in the opening credits, because the idea was they had, when they signed on Tom Cruise and Paula Wagner as producers, they had an option agreement with Cruise with the idea that he would play the lead, but it never got off the ground because Cruise didn't like the first three versions of the script. So it just kind of sat for a while. And I think, again, like I think just necessity being the mother of invention, being something that epitomized Corman movies and has sort of epitomized W.S. Anderson as well, this movie got so much better because of that gestation. And because of the fact that they were never able to, even though this was Roger Corman's, the biggest budget he had been able to touch in years, it is still by no means a big budget movie. I mean, they filmed it at an old train factory in Canada, but they also filmed it with real cars that were like $200,000 a piece to put together, firing blank rounds of real ammunition at each other. Like when you watch the behind the scenes features, it's every bit as exciting as watching the movie because those cars are really fucking blowing up.
Oh yeah.
It's incredible, like the amount of technique and the amount of practicum that went into executing these stunts is phenomenal.
Yeah, this was pure stunt cinema.
Oh, absolutely.
In a way that you don't get a lot these days because of CG and the work here. It is a masterpiece of carnage.
Yeah,
like it is. It is just so tactile and just
great,
so
word for it.
Raw. It really does fire on all cylinders.
Ayo. I like it. That gets my engine revving. But yeah, and I think it just has so many elements that are pulled from, you know, what Corman was good at, what W.S. Anderson is good at, and all the while, it, because it didn't have the money to do a lot of CG, was creating these really phenomenal to watch stunt sequences. And what I find really hilarious is that I actually read this after I watched both movies, and I'd had this thought while watching it. When you watch Death Race, the 2008 version, and then you go back and watch Death Race 2000, Death Race feels like the natural predecessor to the world of Death Race 2000. It is the micro to Death Race 2000's macro. It is basically the fledgling early days of something that would eventually break out of this one island prison and become a transcontinental race. And what I find interesting about that is there are two direct-to-video sequels to Paul W.S. Anderson's Death Race, which, again, I avoided because it's like, okay, now you're making sequels to a remake and it's not even the same. I don't know about this. But what's fascinating about these sequels is that they go back even further and start to connect a completely needless universe, a completely needless chronology that actually fits. Like, they go back to when this sport was, you could order in a pay-per-view, but it was just the inmates, like, with weapons killing each other, like very gladiator style. And then it kind of connects the dots to how it became a race. And the second sequel, or the first sequel, Death Race 2, is about the creation of the very first Frankenstein, the very first driver to be Frankenstein, where he came from, how he came to be Frankenstein. And then the third one is about them trying to push the race out into, they go to South Africa and they're thinking about taking the race across the continent. That doesn't work out, but the end of that movie, I shit you not, is that they're talking about the new warden coming in, and it's a woman. They connect it back to Joan Allen in Death Race. Like, there's no reason for them to take that much care into the mythology of W.S. Anderson's Death Race, but they do. So, as crazy as it sounds, I recommend watching both of the direct-to-video sequels, if only to kind of sit back and cackle at how much care is put into connecting all of the dots and creating, ultimately, one giant timeline for what leads us to Death Race 2000. It's insane. But again, two very different movies, taking two very different tacks to get to one very similar finish line, in that both movies are just incredibly fun to watch for two very different reasons. One is just hilarious and weird and campy. And the other one is a legitimate, I'm going to say this, I think in terms of an action film, it's a fucking masterpiece. Like, I remember watching this movie with you, and it wouldn't be until Mad Max Fury Road where I saw another studio movie that had this level, this sort of almost irresponsible feeling level of carnage.
Automotive violence.
Oh my God. Oh my God. And some of the other characters in this we haven't really talked about. We've mentioned Grimm.
Yeah.
You know, well, this
briefly. Yeah.
Yeah, we mentioned Grimm
briefly. Robert Lizardo.
Yes, who is this terrifying, you know, Mexican character who you know, they talk about, well, there's a character in this movie named Lists, who is sort of just the record keeper and knows everything about everyone.
He's little Mr. Exposition.
Our
flunky little exposition. Mr. Here we go. Exposition. What a show.
So he explains to Jason Statham who all the other characters are. One is Grimm, who is just this like really scary gangster-like character who has the best death.
He has the
in
very best death.
The movie. His car explodes and then gets shot by a rocket so that it flips up in the air, crashes into a billboard. He comes out of that and delivers a speech where he says, you can shoot me, you can blow me up, but you just can't motherfucking kill me. And the Machine Gun Joe's truck comes and slaps into the side of him. And
splatters,
I don't know.
Splatters him.
I rewound this and played it in slow motion. And the movie does it too. The movie shows a replay in slow motion. And I thought that was so ballsy to be like, yeah, we're going to show you this effect again slowly so that you can dissect it. Much like Cronenberg's the head explosion in Scanners. It's like, yeah, play it back slowly. I dare you. I dare you to find the seams. And again, I watched this death and I'm like, I don't see the seams. I don't see that moment where it switches from a real actor to clearly a prosthetic. I don't see it. And I've tried several times. It's amazing how well that's executed.
Was Robert Lizardo in any movies after this one?
Do you think they really killed him?
No, but
I mean, that would be on the nose gladiator sports shit if they're like, we're going to kill this guy just to accomplish the right effect. And I will say this for this movie, for W. Sanderson's Death Race, it doesn't lose sight of the sex appeal that got so many people to buy tickets to the drive-in in the 70s, because every single prisoner, apart from Machine Gun Joe, is assigned a... Look, I've seen plenty of women's prisons in movies, and I understand that in movies, every woman looks like this. Every woman in a woman's prison looks like this. But you want to talk about the height, the zenith of male fantasy is when the bus rolls into the prison.
This movie wearing its influences on its sleeve. I mentioned it before, and this is why Tyrese Gibson's in this movie. They said, let's take Death Race and let's add a little Fast and Furious to it.
Yeah.
And so this is their Fast and Furious moment where the women, the sexy women, all walk off the bus. And
in slow motion.
In slow motion with close-ups of their asses while playing some hip-hop.
Yeah.
And that is, it's like, yep, this scene is in every Fast and Furious movie, every single one, and here it is here.
I just imagine there's in my wild, it being such a diehard, ridiculous fan of the Fast and Furious movies, there is a narrative that I want to believe so badly in my brain where they're on set and Tyrese is like, yeah, man, I'm telling you, those Fast and Furious movies, like, I was in one. They're awesome. You should really do one someday. And Jason Statham's like, I'll file that away. I'll think about that. And then he shows up. Both of them show up in Furious 7 together. And then, of course, Jason Statham is in the Expendables movies with Sylvester Stallone. So there's so many little connective tissue things going on here. But yeah, it definitely has its Fast and the Furious moment when the ladies get involved. And also, speaking of Mortal Kombat, 14K.
Mortal Kombat!
The character 14K, who is a Chinese gangster who is in this prison, is played by Robin Shu, who also played Liu Kang in the Paul W.S. Anderson Mortal Kombat films. So there you go, a little connection. I will say this too, ballsy as all hell, like four of the characters they bother to give backstories to are killed in leg one of Death Race. Now, bear in mind, there are at least three other characters they don't even bother to name until they die. So, I mean, any other filmmaker would be like, let's kill the people without names first and spread everybody else out because we've taken all this time. Nope, it is a fucking reaping in that first leg of the race. They're killing off everybody and doing it like really brutally. Like they construct some methods of death that I think would give Jigsaw a hard on. Like they really go all out, and it's just, man, this is just a really ballsy movie from start to finish, and I'm starting to come around on the idea of putting this above Event Horizon as WSN.
Event Horizon!
But yeah, these are two movies you kind of have to watch.
I can't believe we managed to get that long without doing that.
You know what, Captain Miller? I think these movies are fantastic in their own rights and so different and yet sharing so much DNA, and the way that they pay homage to the original in the remake is very respectful, but at the same time, understanding that it needs to establish its own voice and does so very well. So, yeah, I mean, perfect double feature? I think perfect double feature.
Yeah, yeah. And if you want to go with the Junk Food Cinema triple feature.
Oh, shit.
You can put the cherry on top watching After the Fall of New York, in which our protagonist, while most of the movie is a ripoff of Escape from New York, the opening is him having just fought in a death race.
Oh, that's correct.
With cars.
Yeah.
And which is why I was inspired to show this as the third movie, because it's like, yeah, here we are, you know, with car fighting again. Because clearly that the Italians had ripped that off from Death Race 2000. Mm-hmm. You know, because this movie is literally just a piecemeal of so many other films, and it opens with essentially taking from elements of Death Race and then smushing it together with After the Fall of New York and Mad Max and other crazy pants things. But this is, I honestly, I've always felt this is one of those perfect double features.
And if you've been paying attention to Twitter junkies, then you know that the next film we're going to cover in this series of, it's not really a series, but in this random month is After the Fall of New York. So we invite you, if you've only watched Death Race 2000 and Death Race to prepare for this show, now go track down After the Fall of New York. I will warn you, it may not be easy to find, but you should definitely track it down because that is the next movie we are going to cover. And that brings us, of course, to the junk food pairing, the gasoline that fuels our engine. And this time around, I started thinking about these two movies. I started thinking about the original, started thinking about what the remake has done to take that original and maintain its core concept, maintain what it is at its heart, and yet at the same time, take it to that next level. And it reminded me of a food truck here in town, Cargill, that now has a brick and mortar, a little place called Gordo's. Because Gordo's, if you're not familiar, if you're not from Austin, is a gourmet donut establishment that takes the already artery-clogging goodness of a donut, of a very delicious, very satisfying snack food, and does things like adding, you know, cereal to it, adding like these artisan drizzles, adding all these things to where...
Covering it in pie.
Covering like, it in pie, to the point that what you have is a monstrosity worthy, I mean, a piecemeal monstrosity worthy
Frankenstein.
Of Frankenstein himself. So on so many levels, I think Gordo's Donuts is really just the perfect... Go ahead and get yourself a Blue Balls or one of their other... the Blue Balls one is the blueberry one. It's so fucking delicious. Any of their other monstrosities are well worthy of the double feature that is Death Race 2000 and Death Race. And again, complete the triple feature and come back next week when we talk about After the Fall of New York. Oh my God.
Come next week for Death Race.
Coming up on Junk Food Cinema for the low, low price of nothing because this show is free. But hey, you can do us a solid. Go on to iTunes and rank and review us. Also, follow us on Twitter at Junk Food Cinema. Like us on Facebook, facebook.com/junkfoodcinema. And tell any and all who will listen about the fattening wonder that is this podcast. Cargill, where can people find you online?
You can find me on Twitter at Massawyrm. That's MASSAWYRM. Or on facebook.com/Massawyrm.
All right, and you're working on Doctor Strange, which is released when?
Comes out November 4th, and it has a couple of interesting people in it, you know.
I feel like we don't even have to tell, but like, hey, go see Cargill's new movie. It's a fucking Marvel movie.
I'm surprised
you're going to see it.
Like, it's anybody listening to Junk Food Cinema isn't going to see a superhero movie.
How about that Phantom, though?
Phantom.
Yeah, Billy Zane was the bomb in Phantom.
How have we not done the Phantom yet?
Oh, we will. Oh, we'll do a whole month on all of those movies.
We're going to do a whole month on the Phantom. That's how much you love the Phantom.
One for each skull, first of all. One made of silver, one made of gold, one made of jade.
I'm having vague memories of one night we were drinking very heavily, and I just kept saying Smash Evil to watch your blood kind
Slam
of
Evil, Cargill!
Because you take the bait every time. Slam. Every time. You cannot let that fly.
Slam Evil.
All I have to say is Smash Evil, and you have to say it. You cannot resist.
You're a member of the Pirates of the Douche Brotherhood.
Smash Evil.
Slam it. Anyway, guys, you can find me on Twitter at BryGuySalisbury or on Facebook, facebook.com/BryanSalisburyCritic. Keep coming back here to Film School Rejects. That's really awesome. It's a great site. Check out oneofus.net, also a great site. And thank you so much for joining us on this show. And remember,
fuck with me, and we'll see who shits on the sidewalk.